Wow. First thing I want to say is it's good to be back home. In addition to growing up in Chester, also lived on 48th and Walnut Street while I was going to Villanova University, and I come back this way from time to time because my family's still in the Wilmington, Delaware, Chester, Pennsylvania area, and I hadn't been to Philadelphia since we came through with the burial ground descendants on the way to their final reburial, so it's a pleasure to be back home. I want to take a minute, preparatory things, to say congratulations to both the Oversight Committee and to the activists who've been involved in trying to make sure that this story did not go back underground again. I've had some experience with having to do a little bit of both of those things, and know that, I find it very interesting that when we make new discoveries about the African-American experience, we have so much difficulty trying to just let people know about it. But I have more to say about that a little bit later. Let me finally say that, I've been most involved for the last, believe it or not, 15 years trying to commemorate the African burial ground. And I want to congratulate you all on the rapid pace, the rapid pace at which you're making progress. Honest to God, when I got involved in this thing back then, and I'm still involved in it, my expectation was that I'd have about a 2-year assignment. And every time I got ready to split, the ancestors would be back on my butt. I have not been able to get out of it. And so I finally said, well, ancestors, what else do you want me to do? And we're working on some bringing some parts of that to fruition, to conclusion, and I'll say some more about that as we go along in the formal presentation. Let me say before I go any further that whatever the title is that's on your paper is not the one I'll be speaking from. I'll talk about those things, but that's not the... I actually chose the title that was, posted on the website a while back. And maybe people change it. I don't know. But anyway, commemorative sites, opportunities for teachable moments is what I've chosen as the theme of my presentation. And a little over 20 years ago, I was contracted by a nonprofit educational reform organization to conduct a study of U.S. history textbooks. Now, the organization had published a rather scathing attack on the ways in which the subject of race and racism had been treated in American history textbooks up to the early 1970s. The ways in which blacks and Native Americans, Hispanics and Asians were represented and interpreted in the telling of the American national story. The textbook industry responded to both the study and to the growing social movements on America's streets during the 60s and 70s, which called attention to America's racial and ethnic and class and gender complexity. And they published a revised and some revised and updated text during the period about 1980 to 1983. I, along with the historian writer Madeline Bedell, was hired to examine these new texts and to report on the ways in which they had changed, if they had in fact changed. We selected the 12 most recently published and heavily used texts representing elementary and junior high school and high school grades across the nation. And we set about the task of trying to see what changes, if any, had occurred in the treatment of race and racism and racial and ethnic groups in American history writing. Changes actually had occurred. Virtually all of the texts now, which wasn't the case in the 1970s, included photographs of blacks and Native Americans and Hispanics and Asians randomly distributed among the previously all-white images that dominated the text of the 60s and 70s. Sidebars, highlighting individuals or events from the histories of these groups, were also liberally sprinkled throughout the text. And finally, a new breakthrough. A paragraph or two appeared at the end of most chapters, recounting the presence and role of blacks and other non-white racial groups in the major events of American history. Native Americans in the colonial period, blacks in the American Revolution, blacks in the Civil War, etc., etc. Significantly, few, if any, of these changes were noted in the core textual narrative of the book. Said another way, we got a chance to get some pictures and some sidebars, but the main story didn't change at all. And indeed, the fact that our story was in the sidebars meant that our story was not cool. Needless to say, the treatment was usually totally inadequate and problematic. Now, as Madeline and I read through the books, we soon discovered that the treatment of racial groups was not the only thing that was problematic with the text. Except for the period of migration and an occasional ethnic-specific disturbance, European ethnic groups were virtually absent from the text. By some unexplained mystical process, after they passed through Ellis Island or some comparable entrepôt, they became this virtually all-white monolithic group. They ran around doing whatever they did, but it was all this one group. And except for highlighting the so-called degree of religious tolerance that America afforded colonists during the colonial period, the subject of religion was strenuously avoided. All of the major military encounters appear, but there was little or no attempt to recount the history of organized opposition to wars and militarism in the United States, which has happened in virtually every war.
Right. Right.
Class as a determinant of social organization and practice was scrupulously avoided, as was sexism and the role of women in America's historical development. Finally, no attempt was made to honestly and critically explore America's colonial past or present. The book that we produced, Thinking and Rethinking U.S. History, reported our findings on the treatment of all of these issues and themes. Methodologically, we read the text, selected the problematic passages that are representative of events from each of the texts, and then after comparing them one to another, we read the appropriate secondary literature, and this is very important for you to know. The scholarly literature is always years ahead of what's in the textbooks. We read the scholarly literature, the secondary literature, and were able, based on that critical review, to write critical assessments and alternative ways of approaching each of these topics.
Yes, sir.
What became obvious to us early on was that the textbook authors were consciously trying not to deal with certain issues and themes, even though the scholarship was available. I like to put it in the category, people seem to have a need not to know certain things. And when you have a need not to know, part of it usually stems from the fact that if you know it, then you have to take some responsibility for your knowledge.
Right.
It's easy to cop the plea. Oh, I didn't know anything about that. Easy to cop that plea. And then you don't have to take responsibility for anything. At any event, when the nature of an issue made avoiding it impossible, they devised very elaborate literary strategies to avoid saying what was indeed known in the field about the topic. Much of this approach was used to limit the amount of controversy and conflict that could be engendered by the text. Textbooks, in other words, were not supposed to be meeting grounds, places where you could engage students and others in the study of the frankly conflictual nature of the society. Said another way, you can't live a contradictionless life in a contradiction-filled world. Huh? You can't live a contradictionless life in a contradiction-filled world, and you can't write a contradictionless history about a contradiction-filled history. All too frequently, unfortunately, teachers, educators, educational policymakers, and textbook publishers have sacrificed the pursuit of truth and knowledge in the interest of avoiding controversy and conflict. It's time for that to stop. I open this presentation with a recounting of my efforts to study American history textbooks because, in some respects, grade school and high school history classrooms are the most public settings in which Americans learn about the history of their country. I said public settings. Okay? You can go back and sit and do your reading, etc., or you can check stuff out on television, but in classrooms, if you're in a public environment, and that's where we're supposed to learn about the history. The textbooks are the voices of authority, the bearers of truth or misinformation in those settings. Said another way, American history classrooms are, in fact, commemorative sites that have been charged with the responsibility of passing on from one generation to the other what I choose to call the master narrative of American history. I'll have some more to say about that a little bit later. I've offered the preceding as a way of contextualizing the real topic of this evening's gathering, the interpretation of the President's House as a commemorative site in American history. Let me offer one additional contextual comment before returning to a discussion of commemorative sites as opportunities for teachable moments. Most people trace the origins of the African presence in the Americas, including the United States, to the transatlantic slave trade. While scholarship over the last two or three decades has established the fact that people of African descent had crossed the Atlantic and settled in the Americas long before Columbus's maiden voyage, the overwhelming majority of the people of African descent living in the United States and in the Americas generally trace their presence here to the transatlantic slave trade and the subsequent, at times more voluntary, migrations to the hemisphere. Over the course of the almost 400-year history of the trade, an estimated 10 million people survived the Middle Passage and settled in the Americas, North, Central, South America, and the Caribbean. What is generally not known, and even less appreciated, is the central pioneering role that people of African descent played in the peopling of the Americas. Between 1492 and 1776, or roughly the first 300 years of what is commonly called the European colonization of the Americas, 6.5 million people crossed the Atlantic and settled in the Americas, North, Central, South America, and the Caribbean. Of those 6.5 million people, only 1 million were European. The other 5.5 million were African. Y'all in here? Of the original pioneering settlers of the Americas, not just the United States, but the whole of the hemisphere, in the first 300 years of that history. 5.5 million of the 6.5 million people who settled here were people of African descent. Now that simple demographic fact calls into question virtually everything we know or thought we knew about the history of America and the history of Americans. Not only do we not know very much about the African-American history in this hemisphere, we likely know even less, even though a lot of books have been written, about American history in the hemisphere and in the national sense of the term. Why is that? Because the majority of the people involved in American history making in this hemisphere during the colonial period have not been included in the histories that the masters and their surrogates and defenders have written. I'm inclined to agree, at least in part, with historian Lerone Bennett when he wrote in his book, or pamphlet, The Challenge of Blackness, that In the field of history, for instance, people are always talking about integrating Negro history into American history. What these people don't seem to recognize is that American history does not exist, and that it cannot be created if we do not start all over again and view American history from the standpoint of the blacks and reds as well as the whites. And if we extend that insight to all dimensions of American history, we will realize that blacks lived a different time and a different reality in this country. And the terrifying implications of all of this, terrifying for whites, he says, is that there is another time. There is another reality. There is another America, if you please. We can't deal with the black experience. This is Bennett Still. We can't deal with the black experience until we realize that the black experience raises fundamental questions about the total historical process, and that it requires a radical recalculation of our ideas about history and about humankind. Vincent Harding underscored this point when he said, on challenging the rewriting of American and African American history, he said, "We want to know America at its depths. And it's clear even now that the black past can't be remade and clearly known without America's larger past being shaken at its foundations." The larger American past that Harding is referring to, and the American history that Bennett does not exist, is what I refer to as the traditional master narrative in American history. Now, this traditional master narrative dates back to the origins of American history writing, a form of political history in its essence. Its purpose has been to rationalize and justify the supposed manifest destiny of the American nation. It traced the origin and development of the American state, crafting and affirming its ideology, celebrating its governmental structures and leaders, and charting and affirming its processes of mobilizing and dispensing economic, political, and social power. Like all political history, the government and its corporate handmaidens have been the principal actors in the history-making process. Citizens, individually and collectively, are mere objects of or participants in the history that corporate and government leaders make. When the American people play active roles in this concept of American history, they appear as reproducers, maintainers, and or defenders of this thing we call the nation state. Their social and therefore historical significance is primarily defined by their roles as voters to reproduce the state, taxpayers to finance the state, workers to produce goods and services for the state, and parents to produce more citizens for the state. And finally, soldiers to defend the state and or carry out its acts of aggression. American history in this traditional master narrative moves effortlessly from its supposed European antecedents through the colonial period and the American Revolution through the most recent presidential election, emphasizing each step along the way the roles of government, governors and presidents, corporate and military leaders, wars and military campaigns in the making of American history. And while these elites must be included in any sound history of American society, and while American military endeavors are important events, something more is needed if we are to write a history of American society that's reflective of its ethnic, racial, religious, and cultural heritage and social processes. American history and culture making has been a much more complex process than the master narrative would have us believe. Now, over the last 30 years, significant progress has been made in the scholarship in terms of deconstructing this traditional narrative and giving voice to the majority of the American people who have been makers of American history. Native American scholars and their associates have transformed Native Americans from perennial losing protagonists in this manifest destiny narrative to human beings engaged in as critical actors who were involved in a process of struggle that they might both define, legitimize, and give authority to their perspectives, as well as the complexities of their societies and cultures, as well as their encounters with Europeans and their interactions with Africans. A more nuanced treatment of the Native American experience within the context of American society. African American scholars and others, seekers of truth about the relationship of African Americans to the evolving American narrative, have challenged the traditional narrative and staked out alternative theoretical and conceptual frameworks for viewing and knowing America and the American experience. Women and Hispanics and Asians and others have developed new scholarship that demands alternative approaches and interpretations to the traditional American narrative. And traditional, what's been discovered as this has gone forth is the traditional narrative simply cannot contain all of this new knowledge. Either stick it on the sidebars or you have to disappear it. Because if you bring it into the center of the narrative, the original narrative has to change. Most importantly, the authority of the traditional narrative has been broken. The presence of enslaved Africans at the President's House here in Philadelphia, after slavery had been abolished here, make it clear that the old narrative could not contain the new histories and the new perspectives and content that now is before us. What the President's House Project, like so many other public history projects, have had to face is that if they are going to talk to the diverse publics that visit such sites, to ordinary citizens, to students and others, not just to other scholars, they are required to reflect the diversity of all of the participants in the events rather than just report or repeat the traditional narrative. This is because when you go to those sites, real people, blacks, whites, and others, who are descendants of real people, blacks, whites, and others, who lived in the past, will meet on these commemorative sites, and they expect to find reflections of themselves and their ancestors in what they see. As you know, you don't know this. About a month ago, I spent 2 weeks in South Africa. I'd gone there for, this was the first time I'd gone back to South Africa since the elections transformed it into a new South African state. Now, as you know, South Africa did establish its first democratic society about 10 years ago. And one of the major challenges facing the government and the people of South Africa has been the rewriting of its history. The history written and taught, or I should say imposed, on the society by the South African apartheid regime obviously did not reflect the views, perspectives, and images of the majority of the indigenous South African population. Neither did the nation's public history, especially its commemorative sites. Monuments, museums, historic sites, and public buildings were all built to celebrate and commemorate the Boer minority and to basically tell the story of their triumph both over the British and over the African populations and their efforts to maintain them in a state of apartness. Sites to commemorate this indigenous population was virtually non-existent during the apartheid era. The post-apartheid regimes of Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki have prioritized erecting monuments, memorials, and museums to celebrate and commemorate the struggle against apartheid. Among those created during Mandela's tenure was the Hector Peterson Museum in Soweto, South Africa, and the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg. I visited both of them. The former commemorated the students who had died in the Soweto Uprising of 1976, and it's named for the first student who was gunned down by the South African police in that uprising. Significantly, and this is interesting, most of the film footage that documented this three-day crisis, quite frankly, was shot by the South African police forces. And because, of course, it belonged to the state, when the state gained control, they had the evidence, to document everything, and they put it into these museums along with some incredible still footage and, of course, narratives taken from many of the individuals. Neither the film footage nor the museum paint the apartheid regime in a favorable light. The power of the museum is that its storyline does not avoid the conflictual, the contradictory nature of that experience and its consequences. Responses of white visitors when I was there, who I observed, ranged from feelings of guilt and shame to feelings of disbelief and outrage. Black visitors were, for the most part, outraged. They shared the students' pain and suffering, and at times expressed a desire to avenge their losses. Significantly, no one seemed to act on these impulses and urges, even though I personally, quite frankly, felt so outraged at times that I wanted to smack somebody. I came away wondering what kind of people could do this to children.
True.
No one left the museum without learning something about the major event, this major event in the anti-apartheid struggle. What the Hector Peterson Museum did for the Soweto Uprising, the Apartheid Museum did for the anti-apartheid struggle as a whole. The nobility and courage of those who struggled against apartheid is celebrated and commemorated, and the oppressive, exploitative, and dehumanizing nature of apartheid is exposed graphically. In both of these instances, the creators of the museums have been engaged in rewriting the nation's public history, giving voice to the perspectives and views and experiences of the South African majority while deconstructing the history told by the apartheid regime. The real reason I was in South Africa was to participate in the development of still a third commemorative site, Freedom Park. Freedom Park is being built in Pretoria, South Africa. It is an initiative of President Thabo Mbeki, and its purpose is to honor all of the freedom fighters who died in the struggle for freedom in South Africa. A major feature is a wall of respect that will bear the names of the hundreds of thousands of people whose lives were sacrificed during that horrendous time. I've been involved as a consultant helping to plan both the museum and a Pan-African archive for the facility. Now, interestingly enough, it's sited on a hill overlooking downtown Pretoria. Directly across the way, on the very next hill, which is of equal height, is the Voortrekker Museum, built by the apartheid regime to commemorate the Boer War and its triumph through apartheid. Significantly, the Boers are starting to feel left out of the planning of Freedom Park. They are actually almost insisting that the Boer story be told in Freedom Park too. Even though... Well, the Boer story will be told, but it won't be told the way that they would have it told. equally interesting in this regard is that the colored population is also feeling left out. Now, the way that the interpretive framework of the museum has been cast, anyone who committed themselves to the struggle for freedom of the indigenous people will be in it, colored, white. We actually went to Cuba and identified all of the Cubans who fought in and died in southern Africa to defend South African freedom during that period of time. Their names will be on the wall. And so the only litmus test is where were you when the struggle was going down? If you were on the side of the struggle, then you're in the museum. Probably seen in a positive light. If you were on the other side, you'll probably be seen in the museum too, but you probably won't like it. But that's the way that is. These South African examples are useful because of their immediacy on the one hand, and because no one doubts that the new nation cannot go forward without rewriting its history and putting a new face on its public self. The same, I would submit, is true of the United States. But because we've taken so long to recognize this fact, there are entrenched interests who are so committed to perpetuating the old history that they cannot imagine how really liberating the new history could be. Let me conclude with some discussion of a site that I mentioned earlier that I've been involved with for 15 years. I speak, of course, of New York City's African Burial Ground. It's still, as I said earlier, hard for me to believe that I've been doing this for 15 years, and it's still not finished. Fifteen years ago last month, the burial ground was, and I put in quotes, discovered. I say discovered in quotes because numerous historic maps had indicated that there was a Negro's burying ground on the site which the U.S. General Services Administration had chosen to build a 40-story federal office building. Because there were numerous other structures built on the 5 to 6 acres, the overall 5 to 6 acre site, virtually everyone assumed or hoped that the burial ground had been destroyed. Because the land building was 40 stories high, contractors were required to dig deeper than usual to lay the foundation. Most of the surrounding buildings were a mere 5 or 6 stories high. At 25 feet below grade, they began to unearth human remains. The bodies of enslaved and free Africans who had been buried there during the late 17th and 18th centuries. Eventually, 419 of the estimated 15 to 20,000 enslaved African bodies were removed from the site to make way for the building. I was initially asked by Mayor David Dinkins to chair a committee to advise him on what we should do. I was eventually named chairman of the Federal Steering Committee on the African Burial Ground, whose charge was to develop a memorialization program for the site. Within the period of about 9 months that we were allotted, we actually produced the report on memorialization and submitted it to Congress. It has guided the development of commemorative activities at the site since that time. And I regret to say that it was, with the exception of the building, the only thing that has been completed on time in the history of this project to date. It's a fact. Resistance to doing anything came from all quarters. First of all, resistance to memorializing the site came from both government officials and a lot of individual white citizens. There were those, excuse me, we decided that we wanted to do scientific study of the bodies of the ancestors. Excuse me, just a second. And I'm almost finished. We decided we wanted to do scientific study of the human remains. And I'll just tell you two of the crazy sagas that went on. The first one was that someone in city government said These bodies are city property and should be, and therefore should be studied by a city institution. I'll have to say any more about that. There was a very clear, as we did a kind of survey of the field, there was only one scientific laboratory that did skeletal biology in the country that focused on people of African descent. And that was the skeletal biography biology lab at Howard University. Every effort was made to keep us from, basically keep Howard University from getting the contract to do the science. We were ultimately successful with that, but there were, I can't begin to tell you how many efforts to undermine that effort. Put together review panels to look at the proposal from people who were, by the nature of the work that they do, fundamentally antagonistic to the methods and approach that had been proposed. Competing schools in the field, we actually ended up getting some people on the review panel, and by the time they finished, everybody agreed that that was the proper way to go. But struggle all the way through. While blacks saw the site as evidence of the city's slavery past and wanted to commemorate it, many whites refused to believe that slavery had ever been in New York. There were actually people who tried to turn the African burial ground into a pauper's graveyard so that they could honor whites as well as blacks. A group even petitioned the city to let them, this is before we had actually gotten our memorialization plan adopted, a group petitioned the city to let them put a preemptive marker on the site, labeling it a pauper's cemetery, and thereby denying or at least muting the African character of the city. Fortunately, we saw to it that the city turned them down. A commemorative art program that we proposed for the building itself was also contested. When it was clear there was going to, that we were going to win, an attempt was made to donate a body of unrelated artworks that had been done for a courthouse across the plaza to the building so they could be displayed alongside the burial ground commemorative works so that, I don't know. That had nothing to do with the burial ground. For the longest time, GSA refused to offer more than 2,500 square feet of space in the building as an interpretive center for the site. And to date, we still haven't made much progress in our efforts to build a world-class museum to commemorate the site. But thanks to the National Park Service, an enlarged interpretive center is now being planned, and we look forward to having it developed in partnership with the National Park Service to make sure that we have adequate space to adequately tell this story.
Okay.
Controversy also surrounded the building of the memorial monument on the site. There are those who wanted to leave the designated site a field of grass which they proposed to designate it as a sacred cemetery.
Okay.
I was among those who argued for a permanent, immovable monument. Why? Because the graveyard was left unmarked 200 years ago. It was covered over, built upon, and lost to history for the better part of 200 years.
Dang.
The granite monument that we've selected to be built will last forever, and neither the site nor the ancestors buried there will be forgotten again. Well, I don't know if you can see it, but this is actually, I think Faith has a better picture of it she'll put up, but that's the monument that will go on the site, and it's a full 25 feet high, and it's wonderful. Has all the stories in it. Now, this is further ensured because in February, President George W. Bush, the only thing he's done thus far that I fully support and agree with, President Bush designated the site a national monument, put it on the same plane in the Park Service's hierarchy as the Statue of Liberty. Through this act, the federal government takes responsibility for preserving the site and supporting its commemorative and educational initiatives in perpetuity. What is to be taught? A host of things, but certainly one, that slavery was a northern as well as a southern phenomenon. Two, that slavery in colonial New York was part of this pioneer, the enslaved Africans in that burial ground, like the enslaved Africans who were working at the president's house, are part of that pioneering group of 6.5 million Africans who did most of the work in settling the Gulf of Mexico. And third, that the African involvement in the building of New York, from its forts and bridges, of people don't generally know this. And again, wonderful new history has been discovered as a result of this project plan, a catalyst, including the extraordinary exhibition that was presented at the New York Historical Society on slavery in New York. And there's a follow-up show coming in October on New York and the slave trade after the slave, New York slavery and the slave trade after the slave trade had been abolished. And slavery had been abolished. That'll be opening in October in New York to further explore this story. All of this is to say that fortunately, through these and literally hundreds of other efforts that are taking place across the country and across the world, the silence surrounding the history of slavery and its impact, slavery and the slave trade, and the impact on the making of the modern world, the silence is now being broken.